I don't think there's a clear winner between centralized teams versus decentralized teams, at least in my area of purview. It's not very clear to me that centralized teams somehow like work better or a lot more efficient, or decentralized teams are not in that sense, outside of being able to gather context in a much faster way.
You're tuned in to the Data Masters podcast. In each episode, we dissect the complexities of data management and discuss the data strategies that fuel innovation, growth, and efficiency. We speak with industry leaders who share how their modern approaches to data management help their organizations succeed. Let's dive straight into today's episode with Anthony Dayton.
Welcome to Data Masters, the podcast where we delve into the minds of data-driven leaders who are shaping the future. Today, we have the pleasure of hosting Natarajan Subbiah, the Chief Product Officer for Uber Freight. Natarajan is a seasoned product leader and marketplace expert with a proven track record scaling businesses and driving innovation. Under his leadership, Uber Freight has grown into a major player in the logistics industry, handling billions of dollars in freight annually. In the course of this podcast, we will explore Natarajan's insights on data science, marketplaces, and how they apply to the future of logistics. Welcome to Data Masters, Natarajan.
Thanks, Anthony. Happy to be here.
Excellent. So I thought we might start with the idea of being data-driven. And obviously we know Uber is a very modern organization, very much a data-driven organization. I suspect that's a core piece of what you bring to the organization. But equally, we know that not every decision can be entirely data-driven, and we need to strike this balance between using data, finding data, bringing data together, getting into a condition where we can make a decision, and using our gut, intuition, our experience, that sort of thing. So maybe talk us through how you approach that, both in your role, but more generally over your experience.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think if you work in a Silicon Valley industry or in a company here, you're most likely accustomed to using data heavily in decision-making. I think that's been the case for me for the last 20 years, although I do think the tools we've used over the last 20 years has certainly gotten better. Marketplaces, by nature of the business, is very data-driven in the sense that to grow a marketplace, you kind of have to lean on data to zero in on areas where you can move supply and demand in lockstep. And just by nature of that, you tend to have very data-oriented people in the room making decisions. So I think naturally, we've been very data-oriented, and the business we do is very data-heavy. And Uber's taken that one a few steps into the future. I would say at Uber Freight, I was privy to seeing that, having a seat at the table, because logistics is just such a large, massive industry, lots of confounding factors. And historically, logistics has been a very human, with tribal knowledge driven kind of an industry. And Uber Freight, where we were the pioneers of bringing things like upfront pricing into the industry. This is where we can automatically calculate the price for load or whatnot. So from that perspective, I think we're definitely on the data heavy side when it comes to decision making. In the past, just even reflecting my own path, the teams I managed in the past, where I think the dangers lie is when a team moves from a data dependent decision making process to using data as a crutch from not making the decision. This is where instead of using pattern recognition or, like you said, gut or intuition to make some decisions to move forward, measuring risk on the other side of what decision you make, you just wait for data to make that decision for you. I feel like we strike a really good balance, but I feel I've seen teams do that. The simplest of things you can imagine is like change the color. You know, there are arguments on both sides of this. So for example, if you think the risk of shipping something out when you're running an A-B experiment is close to zero, there's no reason for you to wait for 3 months to kind of get your sample size to a certain level where you get a p-value of 0.05. So that part is a good fine balance. And at least sitting where I sit, that for me is always in the back of my head. I think we do, you know, it's a you cross the lines a few times and then you correct for it, as opposed to just, at least, or that's what we do here, or as opposed to just trying not to get the data pieces at all. So it depends on the voice in the room.
I was just talking about this with someone recently. On the other side of that coin, I think there's this feeling sometimes when organizations make decisions without data or based on intuition, that it can be interpreted as favoring one person or one team over another. People will invent reasons why decisions were made. And being data-driven allows you to remove the personal from the decision. Like, we're going to do A because the data tells us, not because I like person A, you know, the person who's in favor of A more than the person who likes B or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like it also depends on the culture of a company. If it's very hierarchical, obviously the person whose voice, within air quotes, matters the most gets construed as the direction we need to go in. And I do think like being data-driven helps avoid things like that. But, you know, it's not the only solution that to solve for problems like that.
So you mentioned this, and I wanted to dig into it a little bit, this idea of a marketplace. And you've had a long career in building marketplaces, and most recently, obviously, Uber Freight. Can you talk us through a little bit about the experience building and scaling marketplaces, in particular, some of the key challenges you've encountered as you do that? And then also, bringing this back to the prior conversation, how data science and data plays a role in overcoming those challenges. What's, you know, in the context of a marketplace?
I'll maybe try to talk about it from a few different perspectives. I think marketplaces are hard to build, hard to establish, but then once established, have strong moats because the marketplace effects are just extremely hard to replace. And I've been lucky enough to either go against existing marketplaces, trying building new ones, building demand-side market-driven marketplaces, supply-driven marketplaces. But there are a few common threads that I could probably thread through all of them. I'll maybe talk about that. One is like, you know, there's a North Star metric for all marketplaces, and that is liquidity. Liquidity is what I would say is like how much in lockstep your supply and demand is. To grow a marketplace, or the easiest way to grow a marketplace is if you can constrain it on multiple dimensions. The easiest way I can think of, like, let's just say you're building a dating app. The way you constrain it is by constraining it to a specific city. You're only building it for San Francisco. Therefore, the supply in San Francisco should match the demands of in San Francisco. If you didn't constrain it, meaning you got let's just say 1,000 people from one section and another 1,000 people on the demand side, but the 1,000 people, one of that sections lived in San Francisco and the other lived in New York, you don't actually have liquidity. You may have the same amount of supply and demand, but you just don't have liquidity. And then there are marketplaces that are more supply leaning and the marketplaces that are more demand leaning, meaning if you're building a job site, you can only get applicants if you have enough jobs. For contractors, for example, they will migrate to whatever marketplace that actually gives them the most, that becomes part of a larger part of, section of their revenue. And there are supply-driven marketplaces. You will only, you're not going to not order from a restaurant because it's not on a delivery app. You're going to still order from your same restaurant. You're going to pick up the phone. Yes, it's going to be a little bit more frictionful. So supply-driven marketplaces. So figuring all of these pieces out, that piece out is very important. And I do think data helps quite a bit there, either to seed which cities you want to go after or how you want to constrain it, or defining what tips a market. Usually once you tip a market, and let's just say, take the same example, dating, let's just say building a dating app in San Francisco, you've got 1,000 people in supply and 1,000 people in demand, and you now tip the market, meaning getting the 1,000 and plus one, both on the supply side and the demand side is now lower, cost is lower. So figuring out what the tipping point is important is the next, usually the first questions you need to answer. Once you figure that out, how do you figure out which cities to expand? You can obviously do the biz development or like the corporate development approach of like looking at sizes of the city, addressable market size, et cetera. Or you can actually take another approach, which is value risk. How much risk do you take on by kind of expanding into other cities? If you've got $10 million to spend, how do you sequence the next set of expansion areas? That's just a problem we actually kind of look at very frequently, meaning our marketplaces are more lane driven. So when we bring supply to a specific lane and demand to a specific lane, it's much easier for us to develop liquidity on neighboring lanes than it is going to be from across the country. So figuring those pieces out is also heavily data driven. And then you start seeing migration of habits of people using marketplaces. Okay, I'm bringing in X, Y, and Z user. I'm seeing that the top, you know, the 80-20 rule is very heavy in marketplaces from what I've seen, where 20% of our users will contribute to 80% of the value, whatever the value you define. So how do you identify them? How do you cultivate them? How do you actually figure out which channels you are very, very good at bringing them in? All of those things are heavily data-driven, and we've used data in the past.
Extremely interesting. And I think one really important idea there is that marketplaces are a very unique market that you're trying to build. And it's probably also, maybe we should have started here, but I think most listeners have an intuitive understanding of Uber in the sense of getting a taxi or a ride somewhere, maybe Uber Eats and getting food, but probably less familiarity. And I would guess that most listeners are not users of Uber Freight. So we've talked a lot about using data to drive decisions, what makes marketplaces unique. Maybe you could share a little bit about who is Uber Freight or what is Uber Freight, and then how these two things have come together to create this unique player in the market in Uber Freight.
Yeah, I think Uber Freight is the largest 4PL in the US. So let me take a step back. Everything you and I touch gets moved at some point on a truck in the US. In fact, 80 to 90% of anything we touch, either complete goods or supply parts for goods we consume, gets moved on trucks. It's $1 trillion of spend just in the US alone, obviously spread amongst owners, doing it themselves, brokers, and then the actual marketplace of carriers. We just spend a lot of money every year moving things around. There are different kinds of players in logistics. Uber Freight is the largest 4PL player in the US. What that means is this is where a shipper comes to us and says, hey, I need to spend $3 billion of freight, meaning just moving things around, that's my expense every year. So you can think of retailers, you can think of like supply, CPG companies, where they spend a very large portion of their revenue ship moving things around, and they come to us and say, hey, we need to better manage this. And we build software and products for them to kind of help them do that better. And not only we actually build the products, we also offer the service of like, why don't you let us, the experts, manage it for you, and we can help you save money on this every year. I think this year alone, we'll save close to $1 billion for our customers for across the board. And we're also a 3PL player, meaning we also provide the service where we are a pure marketplace. All right, shipper, you have a load that you need to move from San Francisco to Seattle. It's great. You've got your own network of carriers, and we see that you're paying $1,200 a month. But we think we have a more efficient marketplace. We've got more people, connected to more people doing this business. And we think we can move that for you for $1,000 a load from Seattle to San Francisco. So we are also the service provider along with like the orchestrator. So that's what we do. And as you can see, we've got $20 billion of freight under management. It is the perfect problem that can be solved with data. It's network optimization, it's pricing, and it's supply optimization as well, right? And historically, this has been done with humans, mostly humans in the loop with some data analysis. We're not extremely smart, extremely gritty humans, I would say, because there are always things going wrong. But I do think like this is, I think the way we actually take it to the next level is by having humans in the loop when exceptions happen rather than having them do the day-to-day.
So it's fair to say that as an industry, this has historically been done, I think you said it well, with smart and thoughtful people. And what you've done and what Uber Freight has done is come in and disrupt the industry by a data-driven approach. Is that a fair way to frame it? I don't want to put words in your mouth.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's the fair way to frame it. I don't think we're at the beginning of the journey here. Again, it's a very massive industry. people who've been doing this for decades, and they've squeezed out optimizations as much as they can with humans in the loop. We think the next order of optimization is by actually bringing the networks together and then being able to make real-time decisions on this thing.
Experience Tamer's proven data-centric AI, engineered to speed the discovery, enrichment, and maintenance of the golden records businesses need to accelerate growth. Tamer's expertise in quickly and accurately unifying large amounts of data across disparate sources gets results faster at a lower cost compared to traditional master data management or DIY solutions. Stop wasting time on bad data. Visit www.tamer.com, that's T-A-M-R.com, to see results now.
So, which actually is a nice segue to what I want to ask you next, which is, as an industry, how should we think about trends and what are the next set of disruptions on the horizon for the logistics industry? And of course, your answer has to include large language models, because that's going to disrupt everything, right?
I actually think I love industries where the structural problems where tech cannot play a large role. And I think freight is one of those industries because it's very cyclical in nature. Because it's very cyclical in nature, you cannot carry large fixed costs. Then R&D typically tends to be large fixed costs, usually the second or the third largest expense for companies in the space. So they needed a deep-pocketed company that can use a platform that's been built for something else on the backbone of the platform being built for something else to kind of come in and do that. And that's why we actually have an advantage in this space, I think. So that's one of the reasons as to why we're heavily invested in this space. So I would say maybe take a step back and say this. I think seek innovations happen sequentially, meaning if you did not build a screen, you cannot build the iPhone. If you did not build, if you don't have the World Wide Web, you can't build websites. And in our case, if you don't have the digitized version of what's happening on the ground in the real world, you can't optimize on things using machines. And that's really the phase we are in this industry. This is what we take for granted in our day-to-day life, things like knowing my spouse, knowing where I am, where my car is when I'm driving. You would expect that to be adopted at scale by this industry, but it's a very expensive thing to do. And it takes time to kind of build the thing out. And that's the phase we're in. But once we actually have that sorted out, I feel like a lot of the automation here will make the networks a lot more resilient. So let me give you an example of what I mean. So every day, there are millions of trucks driving around in the US, moving things around, heavy trucks, large 45,000, moving around 45,000 pounds worth of goods, food, everything. And there's billions of dollars being spent every month doing that. But to orchestrate that move, there needs to be a human who kind of comes in and says, okay, Anthony, you've got this load to move. I'm going to charge you $1,000, and you, Anthony, will have to go to three other Rogers, get quotes from them, and then say, okay, I'm going to pick Raj number one to do it. Now Raj number one goes to the pickup point, the drop-off point, call, email, and get an appointment in these locations. And they could be very different. They may have, one of them may have a website where you can go on and get the appointment. The other may just only do phone calls. So do that. Then I need to go find a carrier who's around the area who can actually move the load for me and then make sure that the carrier is en route across from end to end. Once they drop it off, make sure the carrier sends the proof of delivery to me so I can pay them out. And then I can actually submit that and then you can pay me. All of this in very large amounts is being done manually today. The pieces that I think we've, just in the last few years, the pieces that we've actually digitized are pricing to a large extent. Meaning you can, if you want to use Uber Freight, you can create the load and you'll automatically get what price Uber is going to be able to move this load for. I'm able to send it to my carriers because our app's being used by millions of drivers right now and the largest app that's out there in the freight space. Millions of drivers can immediately see what a dollar amount they'll actually earn by moving the load. And then because we track them, if they use our app and if they track the location when they're moving a load, when they use the app, or you be connected directly into the ELD, which is the GPS on the truck. And now we can track this automatically. appointment scheduling is still relatively manual, I would say. And then proof of delivery, we automatically kind of get that proof of delivery, read it automatically, and then kind of submit an invoice automatically. Now, there are exceptions to this. Obviously, I would say at each level, maybe we're 70 to 80% automation, and then combined, we're in double-digit automation. I feel like today, if you go walk into a normal brokerage, you will see what you would see on a New York Stock Exchange kind of a thing. Loads of people, very confident, on the phone, talking to each other, talking to the shippers, talking to the carriers, negotiating and whatnot. And then there's one specific type of brokerage. This is where like high urgency, high value a brokerage. This is where the highest amount of automation actually exists, where the floors look a little bit more empty, where it's more two people handling that. I feel like that's the direction we actually head in. Then there's also the pieces. I don't know if we are heavily dependent on LLMs to do that, but I do know that they're going to be helpful because a lot of these things are price prediction and then just digitizing what we actually have and then automating it. Then there are parts where, for example, Pepsi does, you know, maybe I should not say names. Maybe there's shippers who do business a certain way. They would want invoices to be done a certain way. There are tons of SOPs that each of our manual operators need to follow. I don't think, and they're manual because it's written down in English. It's not coded somewhere. It's not algorithmized or it's not heuristics based. So I can't follow a specific flow path and instead I have to use a human being to kind of go do it today. This is where I think LLMs are going to come in and help quite a bit. I think right off the bat. So all of these brokerages and carriers are going to be a lot more efficient in doing that. They're going to be able to talk to a lot more people because of that. And I do think that's happening as we actually speak. There are lots of companies that are popping up that are helping us in this direction. And then there are obviously emails, still email, text messages. And if you go international, WhatsApp is still a primary mode of communication between all the parties here. There's no reason for us to wait for a human to kind of respond to it. So instead, I do think LLMs are going to be playing a larger role. But over a long period of time, I do think that 80% of the freight is going to be moved by automated in a very highly automated way. Maybe there are one or two steps that maybe you need to have manual. 20% is going to have exceptions, and that's where humans are going to kind of come in and whatnot. And then it is going to be a lot more 24 hours, 7 days a week, as opposed to 5 days a week that we have today, because there are human constraints here.
Yeah, so take your point. And you said something at the beginning that I think is really important, which is that there are shifts in the industry which enable this new disruptive approach. I've often talked about this in the past. This idea of, I call them exogenous platform changes, meaning it's something that's happening to the industry. It's not something the industry is doing to itself. And or said differently, web pages didn't invent the internet, meaning the internet allowed web pages, to use your analogy, the internet allowed web pages to exist, not the other way around. And so being aware of or sensitive to or watching for those exogenous shifts, a new platform that allows for a new approach. And to your point, digitization of many of these processes, moving them from paper into data, allows them to now to be optimized in ways that weren't previously. So not the least of which, of course, is location information. But to your point about the standard operating procedures of a bunch of different companies, there's probably hundreds, if not thousands, of little pieces of that operation, which are increasingly digital and then increasingly data-driven. Fair?
Absolutely. Yep. You hit the nail on the head.
So let's shift a little bit. You're obviously a leader within Uber Freight as an organization. And as such, I know you've built teams to do a lot of this work. And my understanding is that many of these teams are fairly decentralized and yet high performing, obviously working very well together. I'm curious on how you think about, and this is a kind of perennial debate in the data industry, whether we should have centralized or decentralized models for doing data analysis and data management, but how you think about that and what's worked well for you or and what techniques or strategies you've put in place for managing a high performing team that is decentralized.
Yeah, I think that's a great question as well. And I don't think I'm fully made up on like what direction we need to go in. Well, I'll walk you through where my head's at at this point in time. Uber does require for people who are not remote, people to kind of come in 50% of the time, and they're very flexible on what those days are, et cetera. We are in the world of changing things that are physical in nature, meaning we can't write code in isolation that doesn't just exist online. It actually affects the way 4,000 people internally to Uber Freight, the way they work. It affects our customers in a physical way, et cetera. I do think the bar for remote work is much higher here in a marketplace, a company, or in the freight world, I would say. And that's because context, and context is super important. If I were getting a new person on the team, I'd want them to shadow our operational team. They're working on anything that the operation team is touching or their customers are touching. I'd want them to shadow the operations team so that they understand the context, as opposed to getting that context through either by looking at data, inferring that context by looking at data, or by talking to somebody who's talking to the end customers, et cetera. So I feel like that's very important. That's very key. And I do think that people, especially in the Bay Area, I don't think a lot of us have had tons of context coming into this industry. So I think that's something I focus on early on in when we bring someone new to the team. Have them kind of shadow the teams or talk directly to customers. In fact, I actually have a rule on the team that if you're building a product, you don't actually get to write a line of code until you have 5 design partners, meaning that you've actually kind of reached out, talked to them about the pain point. They said it's a large enough pain point, and they signed up to supporting you through the process of building the product. And those kinds of rules have been helpful. I mean, obviously, it's for the number 5 is arbitrary, but the thought behind it is that, okay, you're talking to customers directly, and then you've got the context before you build a product. I don't think there's a clear winner between centralized teams versus a decentralized team, at least in my area of purview. It's not very clear to me that centralized teams somehow like work better or a lot more efficient, or decentralized teams are not in that sense, outside of being able to gather context in a much faster way. So if you're in a decentralized team and you've got your hooks into the right people, you have the right information flow, I do think that you've got a good chance of being just as effective. Where I do think teams actually move faster slightly is co-location. When you have to, for example, if you're working on a project and you've got like 5 engineers working on the project and 2 data scientists, if they're all in different time zones, it's very hard to make that work. So I do think like we are focused on making sure when there is a separate office, there's co-location of engineers and co-location of teams working on a specific product. And I think that's been helpful.
It's funny because we talk about this question of marketplaces and friction in the marketplace, but it's equally true in the context of work. To your point about time zones, you can't control the sunrise and sunset. Like by definition, we have time, different periods of daylight within different parts of a country or the world. And so that's a friction that's introduced in the context of work. And to your point, like getting teams to work well across many different geographies and time zones and et cetera is extraordinarily difficult and introduces a set of friction into the process that wouldn't exist if everyone were in the same office. Figuring out how to smooth that friction as much as possible, or recognizing that it exists.
Interacting it through other mechanisms. Yes, absolutely.
So I wanted to end with maybe a more like personal question, which is how you stay up to date on advances in data science and technology, and how do you think about making sure that Uber Freight isn't disrupted, but more, and even on a personal level, how you're staying on top of all of the latest and greatest?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. So I'll talk about what I do personally, and then I'll also talk about like what we do as a team. Or maybe I'll start with the team one first. We have something called learning lunches. And we've had this here at Uber. I've had this in the past, some of the past places. This is where people who are super interested in a topic learn a lot about the topic. It may be whatever it is. It could be about the MDP and how you use MDP for pricing versus it could be how you fly a plane. And people come in and then they research the topic. They kind of synthesize this into small pieces or easy to understand pieces. And then kind of like we all grab lunch that one person sits there, presents it, and then we, you know, we all learn from that person. And that's been very effective. The one key I would say is the person who's organizing it must love organizing it. They're doing this in addition to their day job and whatnot. So it's a labor of love from that person. And that has been one of the key pieces that we've uncovered that, okay, if we do that and this is the person doing it, I think we'll actually have good momentum on doing this. I subscribe. For me, I'm a little bit of an early riser. My day usually starts around 5 a.m. And I read, I'm pretty tight about the emails that I get in my personal inbox. And usually my morning starts with me going through my inbox and reading through things. So the way I keep abreast on what we do internally at Uber Freight, I think there's tons of super interesting stuff happening. So reading through our data analysis pieces or PRDs, et cetera, I think that gives me a lot of insight. Oh, this is something new. And then when I don't understand something, I immediately go online and then kind of look through it. We also have like research paper readouts that whenever time permits, I go and take part. And then outside of that, just talking to all the smart people we actually have. Unfortunately, my days tend to be more discussions around business these days than it is about the actual product and the actual data information piece. So yeah, that's how I spend my time.
No, that's great. That's good. I love the idea of topic-based lunches. And to your point, it doesn't even have to be necessarily directly work-related, but oftentimes those things spur a conversation or an idea, and that does end up being positive from a work perspective. Well, thank you so much for the thoughts and insights and for joining us today.
Of course. Thanks for having me, Anthony.
Thanks for joining us for the latest episode of the Data Masters podcast. You'll find links in the show notes to any resources mentioned on today's show. And if you're enjoying our podcast, please subscribe so you never miss an episode.